I'm some kind of MC.
Like a rapper.
Oh, okay, yep.
Where you put this band.
Is that a legit thing?
Yeah, you put your knuckle on that and then your thumb touches your chin. That's a real good length.
Is that really a thing?
That's for real.
That's very close.
I know.
To my face.
These are stage mics, they're not really interview mics.
Okay.
We're on a budget here, right?
Also, is it okay if I drink my coffee?
Just move the mic away.
Not into the microphone.
Not into the microphone.
Okay.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Wombat Radio. We're in Northcote Town Hall. And would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Rachel Perks. What else should I say?
That's my introduction. Comprehensive.
Okay, good.
And you've got a show running right now.
Mm-hmm.
It opened last night.
We've got a show called Ground Control, which I wrote and I'm in. And it was directed by a good friend of mine, Bridget Belotis, who also helped me in the devising process. So she's been kind of working with me on the show for probably a year now. We were talking about this morning, we think it might have been about 15 months since we originally decided to make the show.
Okay.
And it finally opened last night.
Longer than a baby.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a scene in the play where I make some birth noises. The scene isn't about giving birth, but the noises just remind me of birth noises. And I feel like it's quite apt in relation to the way that I feel about the show. Saying that, having never had a child and having no idea what that process is like. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it'd be good to zoom way in, be a little bit descriptive about what's going on, how it came to be, and then we can zoom out a bit more about process over time and things that you're interested in.
Sure. What's going on, like what's literally happening in the show? Or
I guess, yeah, but also what effect you're trying to have by doing it.
I mean, people keep saying that the work is terrifying. That word is coming up a lot. I guess that's sort of an unacknowledged intended reaction. I think we also want to make people laugh, and we also want to make people kind of enthusiastic and excited. The show is, I think it's not a very easy show to watch. It's quite full on. It's very intense. There are some very intense moments. And yeah, I think it's quite a full on experience for the audience. And I think my work is always like that. I think I, as an audience member, I really like to have a really big experience when I go to something. Like, I look for that. I look to be really drawn in and forget that I'm sitting in a theatre and forget that I'm Rachel Perks and forget that I'm in Melbourne and just kind of enter the work. And so I think my work tends to be kind of aiming for kind of shocking people out of intellectualizing the work and just kind of to just enter it and take it on its own terms and say to themselves, okay, well, I'm not entirely sure what's going on, but that's okay because there's enough going on that I'm interested in and I'll just follow as well as I can. Yeah, I think that's kind of the intended audience reaction. Whether or not we get that, I don't know. But, I mean, we had really positive responses last night, which was really lovely. There was some friends and peers in the audience and they said that they seem to be having really positive reactions and reading from the work what we were intending that they would get from it, which I guess is really all you can hope for.
Mm. Would you like to give us a little bit linear? I mean, I know stories only ever become linear in retrospect, but there's been an idea and then some process, maybe some insight to process.
Yeah, sure. Bridget and I applied for the Next Wave Festival with this really sort of shaky idea all we really had was that we knew it was going to be about a woman going into space on her own. And we thought, yeah, great. I tend to have like the world's flimsiest plots and I get really excited about them and I tell other people and they're like, yeah, so that's a sentence. That's good that you've got that. Where's the rest of it? And so we applied with that and we were really lucky that Next Wave kind of took us on our past work, I think, and took us on our potentiality, I think, and just said, yep, cool, we'll program you. And so we had to make a show. And I think because I was writing the show over such an incredibly long period of time, I mean, it's not that long a period of time in reference to how long it takes other people to write things, but I think I'm fairly impatient. And so I kind of was working on it over about a year while I was absorbing all of these different reference points. And so it became about... It never stopped being about the things that it was at the beginning, but it became about a lot more things and kind of added layers and layers and layers and layers, which I think I'm really excited about in the work. I think I put on a play in 2014 called Angry Sex, and I wrote it in a really short period of time. And because of that, sometimes there wasn't enough complexity of meaning in the language and in the characters and in the situations. And it was a little bit didactic. It was a little bit like, hey, I'm saying this one thing and that's really obvious. Whereas I think what I'm trying to kind of work with here is that I'll say one thing and then I'll say something totally opposite, and kind of keep people hopefully questioning what it is that I'm actually saying or what we're saying as a team.
When self-contradiction actually reveals complexity,
yeah,
and nuance and internal, yeah, struggle.
I think that's what I'm aiming for. I think one of the biggest points for me in the process of writing it and of researching it was when I discovered cyberfeminism, which was amazingly something that I had lived 26 years of my life without finding out about. And then I discovered through just Googling, I was like, whoa, what's cyberfeminism? Whoa. And just Googling all this stuff and found all of this like artists in the 80s who were like writing these manifestos about cyberfeminism and about the relationship between technology and the feminine. And then I discovered the Cyborg Manifesto by Donna Haraway, which is an incredibly difficult read. It took me about 3 months to read it because my brain doesn't work in a academic language pattern, and so I was really struggling with the sentences and with, like, you know, half of the language was alien to me and I was having to go away and like look up words and try and figure out how they worked in reference to that sentence, and it was very mind expanding, which was great. But she kind of, one of the quotes, which is in my writer's notes in the program, she talks about irony as a political strategy and as a feminist strategy, and irony being about playfulness and being about humor, but irony also being about kind of, I guess, confusing people and confronting people. But she's got this quote where she says... I'm going to forget it. She says, it's about holding opposite things together because both are necessary and true. And I became really obsessed with this idea that I feel like the kind of governing ideology is that if something is true, then all of the other things that aren't that thing are not true. And that kind of strategy is what leads to such easeful oppression of people who don't conform. And so I became obsessed with this idea and started like working in amongst other ideologies from cyberfeminism, working them into the dramaturgy of the work and kind of trying not to iron out things that I was uncomfortable with, and complications and confrontation and contradiction in the work, and just be like, it's okay that all of those things are in there. I can hold them all together and the work can hold them and the world can hold them. And I can put those things next to each other, and that friction is actually really exciting and leave space for the audience to kind of come into it and try and make their own decisions, as opposed to me being like, this thing is true. Instead, I'm saying this thing is true, and also this other thing, and also this very other thing, and this other thing that you've never seen before or maybe don't want to look at or think about. All of these things can be true at the same time. And what does that mean? And how do you, as someone watching that, make meaning from that? That was a very long sentence.
I feel like you've asked your own next question, which is how those are the questions, I guess, for the audience, but then for you as the author mm-hmm. of the experience, how do you make an experience from that place?
Yeah, I think I set out really earnestly to do that, being like, oh, how do I shape the work around these ideas and how do I make this all happen? And then just like getting really frustrated and being like, oh, no, I'm not doing it and I don't think I'm making it work and I don't really know what I'm writing and it's all just happening. And I think I wrote it far more unconsciously than I thought that I was. And it wasn't really until we got to the rehearsal period where I was like, oh, it's just all in there. Because I was just absorbing all of these stuff and all of these ideas. And I was very lucky as well to be working with Daniel Schlosser, who's an incredible theatre maker and dramaturg. And he's been mentoring me over the last year. And he, as a dramaturg, is brilliant to work with because instead of saying, oh, you know, the structure of the work is this, that or the other, he just kind of like gives you a book to read and says, it's a really interesting story in this, I think you should read it. Or and then you can take all of your own meaning from that and think that there's all these terribly profound things, whereas really he was probably just trying to get rid of a book. Or he'll just kind of like say, yeah, that's really interesting, don't touch that for a month, or I'm not really entirely sure what you're saying there. I think maybe you could say it in a more complex way, or you could challenge yourself more in making that idea. But he's very, very hands-off, but his kind of encouragement and reassurance, even when I felt like I had no idea what I was doing, knowing that he was like, it's okay, it's working, was really great because it helped me keep the work in a place where it's still full of complexity, I think, hopefully.
And do you think it matters even if it's true that when he says it's okay, it's working, do you think it matters even if it's true or not? It's just having someone that you trust.
Yeah.
I mean, trust yourself.
I most of the time don't believe him. He's a very dry person, and sometimes I just wonder if he's just saying that because it's his job to say that. In fact, I would say 100% of the time, I believe him 50%. So every time he says something to me that's reassuring or positive, half of me is like, great, I feel really good about that. I'm reassured and this is excellent and it's all on track. And then there's the other half of my brain that's like, you don't care. Why would you care? And it doesn't matter anyway. And, you know, you're just saying that to make me feel better. And you know, I think both of those things happen the whole time.
And is that just the larger reality of your life as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm someone who...
You get up in a restaurant and they're like, thanks for coming. And you're like, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And you don't care.
Yeah.
If I was here.
Yeah, totally. I think, I think it's impossible. Or I think not necessarily impossible, but I think it's not necessary as an artist to quench the part of you that is constantly saying this isn't working or that isn't true or you don't mean that. It means that you never kind of get to sit around and be like, hey, I did a really good thing. But it means, well, I mean, you can think that you did a really good thing in and of yourself, whether or not you believe other people if they say that it's good. But I don't think I ever completely believe people when they say things are good.
Well, I won't talk to you after your show then.
I tend, when people come out of the show, I feel, I try really hard to not let them talk about the show because I don't want them to feel like they have to.
Mm-hmm.
Because I personally feel like, I'm very invested in theatre and I love theatre. And I have very personal reactions to it. And so I like to not talk to anybody after a show about the show for at least 24 hours. So when I come out of my show and people are there, people who love me or want to support me, and they come out and they, you know, they give me a hug and they'll say, congratulations, it was great or whatever. And within about 30 seconds, I'm like, hey, so how are you? Tell me about what you're doing. Let's talk about anything else, because I really think it's not necessary for you to excavate what you feel about something that you just experienced. And if people get back to you, you know, a day later, a week later, or a year later, and they go, oh, that thing stuck with me, or I really like that thing, then that's amazing. But
sometimes saying it helps it stick with them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some people really like talking about stuff straight afterwards. They really like pulling it apart with other people and really going into
it. Like, it's basically, you could liken a show to sex, and then do you finish and then start talking about which parts were good, or do you just like be together for a little while basking in the aftermath?
That's good. I think that's a good way of looking at it. I think that's, maybe I'll tell people that so they understand why sometimes we just need to be silent together in the foyer. Yeah, I think it's, I mean, yeah, I can't imagine that it would enhance the sexual experience if you sat there afterwards and went, right, so that thing that you did, that was great. Not so sure about the second half, but there was a thing you did right in the middle I was very interested in.
Yeah, where did that come from?
Yeah, I think that's probably, but I don't know, I'm sure some people are into that, you know.
To each their own.
Yeah.
Do you know explicitly the effect that you're going for in the world, like what you're trying to push against or support? Or
I think I was thinking about this last night.
Before the show, when you were thinking, what's the point?
No, when I was lying in bed at 4 a.m. trying desperately to get to sleep. I unfortunately get terrible insomnia during show seasons. So I drink a lot of coffee and eat a lot of sugar. Yeah, I was lying there and thinking about this, and I was like, oh, I don't really know what the show's about. I was talking to Bridget about this, and I think it's hard when you're a writer-performer because you have to let go of any sort of understanding of what meaning is being made in a macro sense, I think. Once you start performing in it, you just kind of have to go, okay, I just have to do my job now. And if I worry about anything else, then I'm going to be doing a really shit job of my job, because I'll be trying to be in control of everything, and that's just the worst acting. And so, yeah, I think it kind of, you lose it. You lose sight of what's happening, and I'm really lucky that I've got Bridget and I trust her so much, and I just know that she's in control of what meaning is being made, and she knows, and that's okay, and I can just do my job. But I think the show is about, I think it's about fear. If I had to say it was about one word. Aren't there all those people who are like, never simplify the meaning of your work? Or if the work is simplifiable, then it's terrible. But I don't know. I think it's about kind of living in a contemporary world and living in a lot of privilege. And kind of, I think there's two things going on in your mind all the time. There's like, this is my life, and I get up and I go to work and I go to the shops and I, you know, and in a year's time I might be doing this, and in 2 years' time I might be doing this, and my future vaguely might look like this, and there's all these possibilities open to me because I am incredibly privileged. And then there's that other part of your brain that's like, people are dying and people are drowning and climate change is happening and women are getting shot and it's all happening out there in the world, and I'm just suppressing it down into my subconscious. And I think that for me, the work is kind of about looking at that, what that means to push that down and not deal with that, not acknowledge that trauma, I think. and to live in such isolation from all of the other things that are happening in the world to people who are so much less privileged than you.
Mm. It's interesting, though, that we're less isolated than we would have been a few generations ago.
Yeah. Well, I think we also just sounded like I went on a rant about how hard it is for me to be privileged. That's really not what I meant.
No, there's I don't think it needs defending, because I think whoever will hear whatever they hear. I think there's something interesting to talk about the necessity of individualism to perpetuate capitalism that privileges some by shitting on the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And the end road in my mind or experience or theory of individualism is like complete mental breakdown and mental health issues and schizophrenia. And so there's something that's pulling us between the true ultimatum of capitalist individualism, which is schizophrenia, and the knowing that we are all one, and we're all trying to live in between those two ends. And that means that there is a trauma as soon as you are aware, and that trauma is real, in as much as if you didn't know, you would be ignorant to the trauma. So maybe you wouldn't know, just before there were broadcasts of war, or before there was world news that happened instantaneously. And I wonder if the trauma would exist then for the privileged.
Yeah, I don't know. There was always a kind of a class system.
Yeah.
It would be difficult to be completely ignorant of the fact that there were people who were less privileged than you. But I think these days you have to fight very hard to be ignorant.
But that fighting doesn't look like doesn't take the form of pushing back against knowledge. It takes the form of belief in something else as being the way. So belief in meritocracy, or belief that belief that God is a man. Like, you first need to think that there is a question to be asked before you can ask the question. You were saying about getting to however many years of age before realizing there was cyber feminism.
Yeah.
I feel that same way about, did a podcast at the end of last year with Leuli Ashraghi.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped me realize that the Philippines is a bunch of different islands with different people and cultures and racial heritage and genetic heritage and stories and ways of knowing and knowledge systems. And I had gotten to 30 years of age without considering that was an arbitrary collection of islands.
Right, that we all call the Philippines.
Yeah, and that the Filipino people are now calling the Philippines because that's what's on their passport to visit other countries and things like that. And we take a certain amount as Australia of people from different nations. And I grew up in Darwin where there was a large Filipino community and was in a breakdance crew where most of the boys were somewhat Filipino. And yet with all of that exposure was ignorant to my ignorance.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I want to think also that it's hard to stay ignorant, but it seems really easy
to stay ignorant.
Yeah, because it's you. So
I think it's, I don't know what it is. I think
unless you go to your show,
then it might be more difficult because we're yelling it at you sometimes, literally. I suppose so. I think it. I don't think I have an answer.
Great, neither do I.
Yeah.
I also think there's, it's interesting to think that we're just one generation and there are other generations that we're coexisting with that have different stories and histories and became who they are in different contexts.
Mm-hmm. Freaks me out that there were like intelligent, knowledgeable beings who were born in like the 90s, the late 90s.
Mm.
I think there's been a massive resurgence in feminist popularity within the last few years.
The feminist popularity that says that you should feel good when you go swimming, or the feminist popularity that says in most of the world women get the short end of the straw?
Well, I mean,
because they're two different types and one makes money and one does not.
Yeah. I mean, I think feminism is as diverse as women.
Yeah.
And as diverse as humans. And I think that everybody has their own feminism, and I think feminism should be called feminisms. But I think that
men can have feminisms.
I think men can have feminisms. It's a very topical question. I had this conversation with a friend recently.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to be careful as a man.
If all the time with whatever you do, just be careful.
Well, yeah, I would recommend that. I think that's what you trade that in for the fact that you get a lot of other things.
Yeah.
But I think you have to be careful of not thinking that because you don't think that women are second-class citizens that you get a badge for that, you know? And also that doesn't mean that you then have permission to speak over women who may or may not be less informed than you, because there are a lot of men who like to explain feminism to women. I think that's a really big problem. I could talk for a really long time about how
something like the Catholic Church came about, because so like, ladies, we know you've got your like connection with the seasons and shit, and you've got like life cycles and stars and rituals, but we know what religion's really about. And then they formed the church.
Yeah. Well, I don't really know how the Catholic Church might have come about. I would say that's probably within like top 10 areas of my least knowledgeable.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
You've got other areas.
Well, yeah, I would. Yeah, sure. I'm going to claim that. I know about some things more than I know about the origins of the Catholic Church. I don't think that's too far stretched. Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know what went on there. It was not good though.
Still not.
It's not good.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the other things that I was thinking, I do a lot of thinking about this show. It's basically been all I've thought about for the past 6 weeks, which has been difficult for all of the people who are in my life. But
are they just waiting for you to come back?
I think that they're actually really excited for me, which is really lovely. I'm very lucky to have many, many supportive people in my life. I think that the work is also kind of about despair, and Bridget and I talking about it being about feminist despair, which is a term that I don't pretend to have made up. But it's about I think the main contradiction in the work is about holding at the same time in your hands total feminist nihilistic despair and also like not being able to release hope and just being like, come on, surely the world will change and get better, and like latching on to every small progression that you see and like collecting them and holding them somewhere inside you and going, it's okay, it's not going to be in my lifetime, but maybe one day, and hopefully before the earth implodes. It's probably not going to implode, but you know, It'll just melt down.
I wonder if we'll get beyond races. Like, we'll realize that was a dumb idea to invent race. and then at some point we'll get a bit better at getting beyond the idea of binary gender.
Yeah,
and that may be the thing that helps feminism the most, is the dissolving of the allocation of.
Yeah. Well, I think yeah, I think I'm not sure about releasing race altogether. I mean, I feel like as a white person, I don't understand race in the way that other people might.
But I think it's interesting to know what type of white you think yourself of.
I'm Anglo-Celtic.
Uh-huh.
My family are from Scotland.
Okay. And is that because there was a large and ongoing invasion from the Nordic countries for a while, and then they stopped invading, and then there was a complete takeover from the Romans for a while, and then they... So I wonder if also, as someone who's white, I am also Roman, am also Nordic, am also Scottish,
yeah,
and that those things are names of land masses rather than groups of people, and that the genes that come with them, and how does that have effect on my cultural identity? There's an incredible artist in Sydney called Victoria Hunt, and I was discussing this with her because she's working on her ancestry and genetics and cultural history and stories and all of that coming with her. And when I was talking to her about it, I can see that what she has done is tried to bring all of this along with her in a world where she's been disassociated from it by outside forces. Mm-hmm. Whereas I have actively tried to disassociate myself,
yeah,
as we are doing by calling out our whiteness and calling out our privilege.
Totally.
And what is it? I don't know. I don't have an answer for it.
Yeah.
But it strikes me that it would be, like you said before, it'd be easy to do one or the other. It would be easy to claim or disassociate. And how do we know ourselves in the way that we're celebrating other races and cultures and ethnicities knowing themselves? Because if we just say that we're a whitewash, then we're undermining everybody's ability to have a past. And
yeah. I just think that's interesting, and I don't really know what to say in response to it, though.
Me neither.
What you were... The idea of breaking down a gender binary is something that I can definitely speak to and am much more versed on.
You think we're on the way?
I think that
we're just on the bounce back. Like, there was a time when it wasn't so binary, and then we got real crazy with it, and now we're bouncing back a bit, and I'll just keep...
I think there are some really, really exciting, incredible human beings in the world, people who identify outside of a gender binary, who are pioneering.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a really, really exciting time to be alive, and I think it's an incredibly dangerous and difficult time for a lot of people who fall into that category. But I think that it's... I think feminism is not necessarily... Feminism is about defense of the feminine as well. It's about saying that things that we might identify as feminine... I hope you can hear the inverted commas in my voice. Things that we identify as feminine aren't necessarily negative things, you know? Mm-hmm. And that femininity and femme, and they can be qualities that any human being in the world can have, and can have one day and not have another day, mm-hmm, or whatever, you know? Like, all gender is drag, and you just wake up every morning and decide who you're going to be in the world, and who you feel like that day and who you feel comfortable as. And some people, that's the same person every day. And some people, it's the sex that they're assigned at birth. And some people, it's not. And some people, it's a totally different thing every day. And some people, it's like a mashup every day, you know, a mashup of all of these different ideas and influences and feelings and identities. And I think that the more that we can go down that path, the better the world will be.
You heard it here first, everybody.
I'm really excited by those possibilities. And I think that I enjoy exploring those possibilities myself. Mm. I think that I identify as not a hyperfemme woman. And I think that has made me uncomfortable in the world for a long time. And I think that it's only really within the last couple of years that I've been like, hey, it's okay to be me. It's all right. Yeah.
I like smashing together false dichotomies just so that everybody sees that it's bullshit. So about for the last few years, my dad and I have been rebuilding an old car that, you know, is loud and goes fast and is like, I guess, a mechanical manifestation of how to perform your masculinity. But I really have been thinking about, okay, so that's one end of the spectrum. How can I put something else within that picture that just trips people up a bit?
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, it was just the music that I played out of the car.
Just lots of Mariah.
Yeah, so yeah, at the very least. And then, but maybe, I don't know, there's some stickers or maybe there's a paint color or maybe there's an outfit that I can wear that is in itself, people see the thing and then all that baggage follows on from what they see. And then they see the other thing. And so hopefully it disrupts some of that baggage and without us ever having a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But then I know that I should not pretend to be or represent or speak for those that I am not. But then we can't just leave the people who are persecuted to speak in their own defense. So there's like, how do I be careful as a man to be a voice for feminism and not assume to be mansplaining feminism?
I think something, the only really thing that I can keep coming back to is about how much it costs you to claim something. Like, how much does it cost you as a man to claim to be a feminist? And if it does cost you a lot, if that means that you're going out and you're having really difficult conversations in the world and you're negotiating things with people that you're not comfortable with, and you're calling things out and you're engaging people on a non-superficial level with these ideas. And you're also engaging yourself with ideas that you are challenged by, and you're researching and you're finding out about things and you're questioning yourself and how you operate in the world and trying to talk to other people who also operate with a lot of privilege. If you're constantly doing that, if that's part of the way that you are in the world and that is challenging and that is difficult, then I think you can claim that. Because I think, you know, as a woman, it is a difficult title to claim because you do get a lot of pushback from the world. And it costs me something to say that, you know. And, yeah, I think it's about how difficult is it for you to say that versus how much you might get out of saying it. You know, like if you're talking to a woman, yeah, who whatever, and you say, yeah, yeah, I did gender studies, I know all about it. Yeah, yeah. I've read Judith Butler. Yeah, totally. And that woman then goes, oh, great, whatever, and thinks that you're this awesome guy and you get something out of that. Then, you know, how much work did you actually do to earn that? Think that would be my way of responding to a man, especially a white man, saying that he is a feminist, I would say that's great. What does that mean to you?
Mm.
And how hard is that for you?
Often not very hard.
Great. Honesty is good.
I know that if I say I'm part of a breakdance crew and we cook dinner for each other when we're hanging out together. So I know that if I cooked a vegetarian meal, I would cop flack for that because vegetarianism is feminine.
Feminized.
It is feminized.
Mm.
But I also know that... Yeah, so that would cause disruption, so I don't do it.
Are you vegetarian?
No, sometimes. I have meals that have no meat in them.
That doesn't make you vegetarian.
Yeah, maybe then my feminism only extends as far as my vegetarianism, which is like...
Occasional at best.
Occasional when... Yeah, occasional and circumcasional. Like when it happens by circumstance, oh yeah, cool.
Yeah. I don't think that's vegetarian. I think that's just eating.
Yeah. Okay, failed that one.
Look, I'm a pretty bad vegetarian. I've been vegetarian/pescatarian, switching in between the two of those for about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Vegetarian. It's really interesting that you'd say that vegetarian is feminized. I think vegetarian is also, you know, like there are parts of the world where vegetarianism is a religious choice or a cultural choice. But yeah, I think...
And a class reality.
Yeah, absolutely. Well. Whereas I think in a country like we live in, it's kind of it's a very white person thing to do. to be able to choose, you know.
Yeah, to be able to say no to a nourishment source.
To say no to food. Like, what is that?
What the hell?
And I think that it's a great choice to make. Like, you know, from a climate perspective, the biggest contribution that you can make to sustainability is to be vegetarian. Farming of animals for meat causes 30% of our greenhouse gases in Australia, and more than all car or plane or whatever travel combined. And people are always like, oh, I'm not going to take a plane. I'm being so sustainable and I'm going to eat a steak. We had a sustainability guy come in and talk to us about Next Wave Festival and about making our show sustainable. And he was like, how are you going to make your show sustainable? And we all went around and I was like, oh, I'm not going to print scripts and la la. And then he said, yeah, cool. That's all really good. But actually the biggest contribution that you could make to sustainability is to not eat meat between now and your shows. And everyone was like, no. And I was like, yes, awesome. I love you, guy.
The thing, I went to a wedding last week outside of Toowoomba. And a lot of the people at that wedding are cattle farmers, or they grow grain for livestock.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have that conversation with them.
Yeah, look, I know it's a very difficult conversation to have, and I know that a lot of people's livelihoods depend on it, and I am lucky to live in an urban area where I can make these sort of decisions.
Yeah. It's a pity to say when you say no to... It's just a shame because I feel like we could replace fossil fuel generation and generate just as many jobs with renewable fuel generation. Everybody who's working digging up coal can build the solar panels. That makes sense to me. But I don't know if everyone who's running cattle can make the tofu.
Well, I mean, it depends on, like, you know, certain things can only be farmed in certain areas.
Yeah.
But...
And it's all farming on stolen land, and so what does that mean as well?
Oh, absolutely.
But that's another conversation I didn't bring up at the wedding.
Yeah, yeah, because, I bet you didn't.
Because all of these people in their understanding of the world have legitimately worked very hard, manual labor, and spent many years of their life and effort and toil to be able to pay the bank back from borrowing the money to buy the land, and they've had bad years and good years, and
yeah,
they're on the same roller coaster. So that it's, I find it really hard when we get down to the, almost feel like I can have an opinion about the macro, but at the micro, it comes down to like a person and how they're living and how the way that they're living is honest and honorable to them and yet has the flow on repercussions of
totally.
What it does and comes from what it has come from. And
I mean, I grew up in a very small country town on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, and the main export of that town, the main business was cattle farming and dairy farming. The biggest event that ever happened in that town, once a year they'd have something called Beef Week. And everybody would bring their cows into the town centre and tie them up around the school. I'm not even kidding. And the whole town would smell like cow poo. And there was a abattoir two blocks from my house that they called the local university because all of the school leavers went there to get jobs. And there were people there who were working farms and who were, you know, like a lot of farmers. There was a small sort of town centre and then this huge area outlying that was still considered the town because there was just so many farms in the area. And a lot of my friends growing up, their parents had farms. Mm. And they, you know, I don't think that they're bad people. But also, like, a lot of those people were incredibly racist because there was an Indigenous population in the area and there was a lot of racial tension in the town, and it was a very racist place to grow up. And it was also a very, like, very interested in traditional gender roles. And, like, you would have been beaten up if you came out as queer at school. And it was a very intolerant place. But I still can't say, you know, those people still, I'm sure, hold in their hearts that they're good people. And I don't want to tell them that they're bad people because I can't say that.
Yeah.
That's not my job to say that. And it's not my right to say that. But I hold very different views to them.
And it seems like that's maybe what you're talking about in your show, is to know all of those things, to see all of the injustice and also see that every person is a person, and you still have to, in retaining your humanity, value them.
Yeah, and I think you have to be, like we keep saying, you are saying that you have to be careful about what you say as a man. And I think that it's about not making generalizations and not making sweeping statements and not speaking from a place of, I mean, if you're speaking from, I think there's something about being aware of your own ignorance, you know, like, I am aware that there are a lot of things that I don't know about, and so I try not to speak about those things like I do. And so I think it's about doing that. I think it's about, if there's someone in the room who has a lived experience of something that you don't and they're speaking about it, let them speak. Don't talk over the top of them. Don't tell them that they're wrong. Don't argue with them. Don't play the devil's advocate just to be annoying because you're intelligent and you've got a degree. Just let that person speak about what their experience is and let them be
heard.
Yeah. And let them be right about their own lived experience. You can engage people in conversation and you can ask questions and you can try and understand and you can talk about your own experience that might be different. But.
And maybe that's the power of theatre, to give alternate experience because not everyone gets a chance to have every experience.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, theatre is a great place to explore the unknown and the absurd and the fantastical, because people come in there and they're not expecting it to be real or realistic, you know, which is really, really great. And I think that's why I write speculative fiction and why I write, like, why I'm interested in absurdity and absurd theatre, because I just feel like if you've got all of this room, people give you all this space in theatre to use your imagination. And so why would you then put something up on stage that looked like real life. So yeah, I think I like to kind of, I like to push the boundaries of what people will let you, to the limits of what they will imagine with you, I think. I'm not entirely sure if that sentence makes sense, but I'm going to stick with it.
So, after all, with all of this effort that goes into the speculating and imagining and manifesting and then performing and then steering people off topic when they want to talk about your show after the show, with all of that and with all of the cost that comes with bringing things up, actually, what is your biggest hope?
I don't really know. or I don't know if it's something that I've brought into the front of my mind in a way that is that I can then articulate it. I just really hope that people engage with the show and that they listen and they feel like they can relate to it and they feel like they can see some part of their own confusion or their own hope or their own fear or whatever, that they can see part of that in the work and that that engages them and that they listen and that they feel like they're in conversation with it and they feel included and that they... Yeah, I mean, I guess I hope that they also feel challenged. I don't really know. I think I don't really believe that people will walk out and be changed. I don't think that, not in any sort of literal sense. I think that maybe if we're incredibly lucky, next time people have a conversation with someone, there might be some filter in their brain that goes, oh, hey, maybe you're feeling like this because I know that this is a thing in the world because I heard it talked about. I guess that's like really the ultimate aim.
And sometimes a vicariously experienced event can serve as a proxy for them to bring up something. There was a book that I read or a show that I saw, or funny that you say that, because there's this person said this the other day and I don't know if I agree with it, but this is what they said, and so it continues to travel in that way,
yeah,
with them,
yeah,
without needing to necessarily become a part of them within the hour-long show or whatever.
Yeah, and I think you know, the show is also, I think the show is, I think women will understand the show. Women and people who are othered by a white patriarchal capitalist society. I think the show is primarily for them and speaking to them, hopefully. And I hope that I just hope that they feel included in the conversation and maybe emboldened to start their own conversations and feel like their conversation or their position in the conversation is valid and is important and is already happening. I guess, yeah. I think there are a lot of people who've been kept out of the conversation. I mean, I get to speak, and that's awesome. And there are a lot of people who don't get to speak. And it's my hope that people who don't get to speak will feel emboldened by it.
Thank you.
having me.